Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1044, interview number 13 with Jim DiGiamio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on January 2nd of the year 2019. And Happy New Year to everyone and to you too, Jim. Jim DiGiamio is the author of the triumphal Destiny Betrayed, which is the focal point of this long and ongoing series of interviews. Jim, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Nice to be with you, Dave.
As something of signature points of political and intellectual reference, I would like to begin this interview with a review of a statement that Ray Rocha, who was an aide to Angleton, and you wrote that he was arguably the CIA's expert on the JFK assassination, certainly in command and possession of more information about the JFK assassination than anyone in the agency. And he opined in a meeting of agency officials that Garrison would most likely obtain a guilty plea against Clay Shaw for the plotting the assassination of JFK. Years later, Jonathan Blackmer, that's B-L-A-C-K-M-E-R, who was an assistant counsel to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, wrote a memo in which he opined that Clay Shaw was deeply involved in anti-Castro efforts in New Orleans and was either a cutout to or one of the planners of the assassination, that is, a cutout of the planners, or actually a planner himself of the assassination. And I think as the audience listens to the remarkable account that is detailed in Destiny Betrayed about what happened to Jim Garrison's investigation, I think those two observations, again by CIA officer Ray Rocha and then House Select Committee on Assassinations assistant counsel Jonathan Blackmer, should be borne in mind.
I totally agree. And in fact, Blackmer, I thought, was... this gets a little bit sidetracked, but we'll talk about it later. But Jonathan Blackmer was so interested in Garrison's case and thought it was so convincing that Robert Blakey, the chairman, the chief executive of the committee, later transformed him off the New Orleans beat. Okay, because he didn't like the way that he was getting so involved with Garrison's ideas. All right? That's one of the things that happened, of course, to the House Select Committee, I devote a chapter in my book to that. We can talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a future interview, certainly. But I thought in terms of listeners observing or digesting what it is that we are going to be presenting in the two interviews today about the infiltrators in the Garrison's investigation, and then transitioning to the media hatchet men who worked with some of those infiltrators, and then eventually next week I hope to get into Clay Shaw's counsel and how they networked with these people. You titled the chapter, or at least the first chapter, about the actual trial of Clay Shaw, Anticlimax. And I think that is a very apropos title, because once once the break had taken place, and once the balls were being scattered in the direction that the powers that be had determined they should be scattered in, I think the outcome of the trial itself was past a point anticlimax and perhaps predetermined. Garrison permitted or admitted the presence in his investigation of volunteers, some of whom turned out to be very good, some of them not so much in the parlance of our time. But before we even get into the infiltrators per se, you write, Jim, about a Denver oil man who made an offer to Jim Garrison. And I think that is something of a signature point of departure for us. Tell us about the Denver Oil Man.
Yes. This was a guy named King who, in the very early days, and I mean the very early days, okay, of the Garrison investigation, went ahead and visited Garrison's office, you know, not knowing who he was. Garrison then went ahead and admitted him into his office, and he thought that King only wanted to talk about, you know, what he had dug up, okay, in because that really had not become common knowledge yet, all right? Well, it turned out that after, you know, chewing the fat for a few moments, King then went ahead and changed the topic and said, you know, a guy like you shouldn't be here in this DA's office off all these bond salesmen's, you know, signs across the street. You know, a guy like you should be on the federal bench someplace. You know, that's much more suited to a man of your intellect. You know, and I could probably do that for you, you know, without very much of a problem. So when he started talking like this, Garrison realized what this was all about. You know, this was about getting him off the Kennedy case, you know, by offering him a rather celebrated position, you know, that would probably pay him more money than what he was making as a DA. And so he basically said, words to the effect, that, you know, nothing is going to stymie me from going ahead and pursuing this investigation to its ultimate end. And so the guy left, and his assistant, the assistant DA, Chambra, said, words to the effect, that, well, they offered you the carrot. You turned it down. You know what's going to happen next. And he was right.
he sure was. And I think before we get to the nature of the stick that was applied to Jim Garrison, and it was very large, very hard, and with many, many facets to it. One of you, in an earlier discussion, Jim, we touched on the one of the many fallacious criticisms of Garrison was that he undertook his investigation into the JFK assassination because he was ambitious and he was a professional climber, etc. And this obviously is yet another point that negates that fundamentally.
Yes, yes. Because if that's what he'd been in it for, he would have taken the offer.
Sure. You know, it's interesting to speculate, just in passing, how many people who have been in a sensitive position and have been looking into something that was sensitive decided, what the heck, you know, I'll take the carrot, and you know, I've got a family to take care of, and you know, I want to pay for the college education, I'd like to live in a nice home. And I wonder how many of the people, I hate the term the system, or the establishment, they both, you know, make me recoil. But, you know, they will do under the circumstances. And just in passing, one, I think, can wonder how many people decided to take the carrot and if some of the massive amounts of fresh fertilizer to which we are being subjected politically and journalistically derives from that.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Garrison was infiltrated, and part of the stick that was applied to him came from those infiltrators, Jim, and I would like you to walk us through this unseemly cast of characters. Why don't we start with William Martin. Who was he and what did he do?
Okay, William Martin was a young attorney who was pretty well connected, okay, in the city. of New Orleans. He was an up-and-coming lawyer who knew Clay Shaw, all right, and knew a fair amount about him, okay? And so he's one of these guys who volunteered to work for Jim Garrison. And again, as you noted earlier, Garrison rather naively took William Martin in, okay? Now, one of the worst things that happened with Martin is that Garrison gave him one of the most sensitive and important assignments that you could have in his office in those early days, all right, the spring of 1967. He actually sent Martin to do a one-on-one interview with Richard K. Snagel.
Wow.
Now, I probably don't have to tell you or your listeners who Richard K. Snagel was, you know, but Garrison ended up believing that Snagel was probably the single most important witness in the whole Kennedy case.
Yep, and by the way, let me review very briefly. We did talk about Snagel in earlier interviews. He was a U.S. intelligence officer who was infiltrated into Soviet intelligence as a double agent, and then while functioning as a double agent was instructed by his Soviet control to assassinate Lee Harvey Oswald, whom they had already determined was going to be a patsy for an assassination of JFK, which would then be blamed either on the Cubans and or the Soviets and perhaps used to start a war. Snagel then on his own did a remarkable job of infiltrating the plot against JFK, and in particular the people in New Orleans whom Garrison had investigated. And when he ultimately proved unable to talk Lee Harvey Oswald out of what he was doing and basically decided against killing him, he went into a bank. Was it, I think, in El Paso or San Antonio?
Yes, Jim? El Paso.
El Paso. And shot up, put a few bullets in the roof, specifically to get himself put in jail so that he would not be party to either, as he put it, treason or the murder of the president. So that's who Snagel was. And Garrison assigned.
That's how important Snagel was. All right. And then Garrison sent Martin to be the first guy from his office to talk to him. Well, it didn't take long for Snagel to figure out, you know, that Martin was CIA. Okay? All right? And this eventually, of course, got back to Garrison. And then Martin was one of the agents who was later dismissed from Garrison's staff. Okay? Now, he was one of the first ones. In my book, I mention a few others, like Bernardo de Torres. Bernardo de Torres was part of the Bay of Pigs operation, all right, and he was one of the guys who Kennedy got out of Cuba after the Bay of Pigs through some ransom dealings with Castro. And to say that Bernardo de Torres ended up being well-connected is an understatement of very significant means, because de Torres ended up working for the State Department. He ended up working with the legendary weapons inventor, Mitchell Werbel, okay? And there were people around de Torres that said that de Torres was actually in Dealey Plaza that day posing as a photographer. And then when the guy asked him, well, how do you know he was in Dealey Plaza? He goes, because he talked about it before it happened. All right? And so that's the kind of connections that Bernardo de Torres had.
Jim,
very, very, very interesting character,
indeed,
to say the least.
Indeed. Has it ever been determined, or was there any credible hearsay evidence about what exactly de Torres was doing in Dealey Plaza? Because it seems it was not just there as a tourist, but any operational indications as to what his presence there meant.
All that we found out later was that the Torres had taken photographs, of the assassination. He had them in a safe deposit box.
Okay.
Life magazine had offered him lots of money for them, but he would not sell them.
All right. Okay. So he was taking pictures.
Yeah. Well, that's what he supposedly told his friend. Yes.
Okay. And Mitch Wobell, of course, a longtime U.S. intelligence officer, famous as the inventor of the MAC-10 and the Ingram MAC-10 and MAC-11 silenced machine pistols. He had two nicknames, one the Wizard of Whispering Death and the Thomas Edison of silenced weapons, and was inextricably linked with not only the CIA operations people, but also the paramilitary milieu that grew up in the early 1980s. Bernardo de Torres was no stranger to Evadio del Valle. Tell us, review for us who he was and how he bears on the case.
All right. In this instance, this is kind of interesting because de Torres was infiltrating Garrison's office in the latter part of 1966, early part of 1967. De Torres was based in Miami, and Garrison actually gave him assignments to do there, out of Miami, all right? And the cover that de Torres used was that he was a private investigator, all right? Now, it's so strange what happened next, is I'm sure everybody who's familiar with the Garrison investigation knows that what happened with Jim Garrison was the fact that his investigation was exposed in the public, and then very soon after that, David Fury was found dead in his apartment. But in the same 24-hour period, Eladio Del Valle was also found dead, and in the note that was on Garrison's desk when he learned about this, it said that Davale was found dead, murdered gangland style, in a direct vicinity of Bernardo de Torres' apartment. All right? So take that as you may, but it might have meant, of course, that de Torres was maybe in on the doing away of Del Valle, unknown to Jim Garrison.
Del Valle was tortured, had his head split open with a machete,
right,
and was shot through the heart, although that could have been with a silenced weapon. It seems unlikely that he would have gone quietly into the night. So his body was found near de Torres' apartment. It would appear logical that the actual doing in the Del Valle was someplace else, and someplace that was at least nominally soundproof. In other words, it would not echo through the streets, because my guess is he wasn't whistling Dixie while they were torturing him and then splitting his head open.
Right.
So certainly that is indicative. Jim, I've heard it said that Del Valle actually was identified as a case officer for David Ferry, or the other way around.
Yes. Yes. And he worked with Ferry, and he allegedly paid him for certain assignments that he did by flying into Cuba.
So basically, right. Ferry buys the farm, and we talked about the very strange circumstances about that. Then Del Valle is found, and not even the prostitutes of the mainstream media could attribute that to natural causes or suicide. Again, tortured, head split open with a machete and shot through the heart. And he was, in some cases, Ferry's case officer, and that was within 24 hours and found near de Torres' apartment.
Right.
De Torres was apparently in Dealey Plaza. Bill Davey has written in Let Justice Be Done that De Torres, as I recall, was also involved with the assassination of Orlando Letelier. Do you recall that?
No, I wasn't aware of that one.
I'll look that one up and I'll mention that because I believe that was the case. There were many of the anti-Castro Cubans were involved with the Operation Condor Milieu that dispatched Orlando Letelier. I'll look that one up and I'll see if in our next interview we can maybe begin with either confirmation or, declining that connection, but it certainly is interesting. The main point being with De Torres that by allowing him into the investigation, this wasn't even so much a case of the fox guarding the hen house as the fox taking all the chickens out, slaughtering them, and sending them to Kentucky Fried Chicken. I mean, this is...
that's one way of saying it.
Yep. And you're not going to get a lot done with somebody like De Torres in the mix here. De Torres worked with, among others, William Gervich. That last name for
right.
The
William and his brother Louis Gervich.
Yeah.
Right. They ran a very large and highly skilled and technologically advanced private investigative service. This was not a guy sitting behind his desk like some typical 1950s gumshoe. They had a lot of very high-tech equipment, like electronic surveillance, all right, and they photography, etc. And one of their noted skills was infiltration. Okay, so in other words, it was called private patrol. All right. So one day, Bill Gervich comes into Garrison's office and he offers his services to Jim Garrison free of charge. All right. And Garrison said right then and there, I should have started asking a few questions. Like, for example, how did he find out about my investigation? Because at that time it was still secret. You know. But again, Garrison went ahead and accepted the brothers and their polygraph guy, Roy Jacob, into his office. You know, he said that, you know, look, this was a big investigation. I was shorthanded, and here comes a highly skilled private investigator offering me his services for free of charge. You know? And so that's what happened. And Gervich worked for Garrison for approximately 3 or 4 months, and he began to be suspicious of Gervich when he heard that Gervich was talking to Walter Sheridan, who was in town to do his very negative assessment of Garrison, which Garrison very quickly figured out was going to be a hatchet job on him. All right, for the simple reason that the whole time Sheridan was there, he never asked to interview Garrison. All right?
Yep.
So anyway, this is when he began to be suspicious of Gervich, and he began to take him off sensitive assignments. All right? And Gervich began to get upset about this. All right? And later on, of course, he came out of the closet, and he began to go ahead and condemn Jim Garrison, and Walter Sheridan then used him, his statements, and Gervich actually copied Garrison's master trial brief and turned it over to Clay Shaw's lawyers, all right? Sheridan also sent him to see Bobby Kennedy, although, as we'll find out later, you know, Bobby Kennedy never bought the verdict that Gervich was bringing him. Now, I found out about this so interestingly through a guy who was from New Orleans, and he was vacationing one summer on the Mississippi beaches, and he was at a hotel, and he was, you know, laying on one of these lawn chairs, and there was two girls, an older girl and a younger girl, laying next to them, okay? And he introduced himself, and they did. And when the daughter said her last name was Gervich, he goes, "Boy, that rings a bell." Okay, I'm not really sure, but that rings a bell. And so then they invited him to their room to have a drink, and the younger girl went into the shower. The guy had his drink, and when she came out, she had different color hair. And the older woman noticed the puzzled look on his face and said, and she says, "Oh, her father does some work for the CIA, so sometimes he wants her disguised in public." And that's when the big bell went off in his head, and he remembered the Gervich name from the Garrison investigation. So that's how I found out about that. Now, the third one that I go through in this Chapter 11, which I appropriately titled Inferno, is a guy named Gordon Novell.
Yep. Before we get to Gordon Novell, though, Jim, I'd like to go back to Gervich and just a couple of points. Ostensibly a private investigator, it turns out he's actually functioning as an intelligence officer. We've seen that with Guy Bannister and others. You've made some references to Jim Hogan's book, Spooks, and that is one of the MOs that figures prominently in that book, is people who are ostensibly private but actually doing work for the federal intelligence apparatus. Before leaving Gervich, and again we should note that he came with his brother to Garrison and then ultimately took Garrison's investigative file and shared it with Clay Shaw's defense. Gervich worked for Shaw's defense from 69, you wrote, and all the way through the perjury trial in 71. In discussing the Garrison Group and Richard Helms' observations, that being the CIA consortium, not consortium, but what would be the word, council on the Garrison investigation, Shaw Helms emphasized the necessity of taking care of what implications Garrison's investigation would have before, during, and after Shaw's trial. I think Gervich's actions are significant in the context of the Helms observation.
Yeah, so do I.
Okay. You know, with Gordon Novell, he is so important, Jim. I'd like to, you know, unless you would like to move on, but some other people like Bill Boxley, Tom Bethel, Pershing Gervais, because Gordon Novell is so important, and I think the detailed discussion and lengthy discussion of Novell would necessarily bleed, and that's probably an appropriate metaphor, into discussion of Walter Sheridan. We could probably spend the whole hour, but I mean, if you want, we could talk about Novell. I'm thinking that maybe Boxley, Gervais, and Bethel would be better before we get to, I think, the guy who's most important in this context. But that's your call. What would you like to do?
Well, Boxley, the difference between Gordon and Boxley is that Boxley actually stayed in Garrison's office for quite a long time. You're talking at least several months. And he managed to go ahead and influence some pretty bad decisions that Garrison either made or was on the verge of making. All right. And Boxley was finally, for instance, there was the proposed arrest, okay, of a guy who was already dead, for example, okay, Mr. Perrin, all right, that Boxley proposed him doing. There was the pursuit of Eugene Bradley in California that ended up being ill-advised. There was the pushing of Farewell America, this mysterious French composed manuscript, all right, that Garrison tried to get to the bottom of, and he never could. Those are some of the things that Boxley pushed on Garrison until finally Vincent Salandria, a famous Philadelphia researcher and attorney, went ahead and decided to take a closer look at Boxley and came to the conclusion that he was an infiltrator. And so then when they went to call Boxley so that Garrison could question him on this topic, as Louis Ivan told me, he called Boxley's house or apartment, right? Boxley said he would come down. He didn't come. So Lou Ivan called him again, told him that, you know, Garrison and Salandria and himself were waiting for him, and Boxley said he'd come down. He hung up. They waited. He still didn't come. So the third time that Ivan called him, Boxley laughed loudly into the telephone and said, "Tell Big Jim, Lou, that we're coming after him with it all." He then cackled into the phone and hung up. All right? So Garrison, later on, with Ivan, went to the alleged apartment that Bill Boxley was supposed to be occupying. All right, he told the landlord who he was. The landlord then went ahead and let him in Boxley's apartment where he had been staying supposedly for several months. And it was completely empty. There was one shirt hanging on a hanger in the closet. And that was it. All right. And so Garrison realized that he'd been had. He also recalled that Boxley would come to work every week with a kind of different briefcase. And usually they got bigger and bigger. All right. And so he realized what he'd been doing, of course, is leaving the premises with his files. Now, that was probably made easier because Garrison made Tom Bethel his chief archivist. In other words, the guy is supposed to be guarding the files, all right? Now, Tom Bethel was another one of these guys who came from out of nowhere. He was supposed to be from, well, he was from England, or he's supposed to be studying for some advanced degree. I think it was Sylvia Marr recommended him to Garrison, and again, Garrison hired him. You know, Bethel ended up, of course, turning on Garrison, and at the end, the Shah's lawyers, right on the eve of the trial, had their complete case file. This was not the one that Gurvich gave him, because that was about, you know, like almost a year earlier, all right? They had the most current case file. And so back in those days, all right, that was not kosher, all right? You didn't have discovery back then, all right? And so Lou Ivan conducted an investigation trying to find out who had given it to him, and they came up. He concluded the fact that it was Tom Bethel. Tom Bethel, unlike in his book, did not confess to this. Okay, Peter V, a wonderful archive researcher, found those documents for me. And Ivan confronted him, you know, with his misdeed. According to Ivan's memo, you know, Bethel started weeping, all right? And then Garrison was trying to figure out what to do with him, what he could try him for, if anything. And Bethel left town. You know, he supposedly ended up, all right, at Mary Farrell's house, according to her estranged son, who I met several years ago. All right, you can make of that what you will. But you know, that's the information that I have. So these guys, you know, whatever you want to make of this, you know, let's put it this way. It's very suspicious that so many people, you know, could have been just, you know, more or less kind of off the street, and they all ended up doing the same thing to Jim Garrison. You know, it's very hard to believe that such a thing could happen.
Well, I think that's why many people,
including myself, believe that these were like off-the-shelf one-option types mm-hmm. that were done before, as we'll get to in a moment, the formation of the so-called Garrison Group. All right, that's what I suspect that they were. Now, do you want to talk about Alan Dulles and Gordon now?
Oh, we could. I think maybe we can get the Pershing Gervais afterwards, since his activities actually were after Novell chronologically. The thing that I thought was so important about Novell, not only his actual involvement with the Schlumberger burglary, the Bay of Pigs, deep involvement with CIA, but he was involved with so many different types of activities against Garrison and working with Alan Dulles. And Novell also, like Gervais, worked with Walter Sheridan. And Sheridan is so important. I'd like to really get into his activities. I think the as I said to you off air, and I think I've mentioned it in some of the interviews, I think for a contemporary audience, maybe the most important part of your very important book is the behavior of the media hatchet people, because we all depend on the media as our eyes on reality, and the portrayal of the world outside of the U.S. and domestic activities are communicated to us by the media. And when one sees Walter Sheridan, and he had a lot of company, and there's a pun there, working with Gordon Novell and these people, it is, I think, very instructive for those of us today, not only looking at the history of the JFK assassination and the Garrison investigation of same, but I think extrapolating to so many other things that we have seen. But again, if you want to leave Gervais for later and get into Novell, I'm fine. Let's have that be your call, Jim, whatever you would like to do.
Well, Gordon Novell he passed away a couple of years ago. All right. I mean, maybe 3 years ago. He was an utterly fascinating character. All right. In so many ways. All right. He was a very, very bright guy who was a very talented, kind of, physicist. All right. And a master of electronics. All right. And it was those skills that attracted him to representatives of the Central Intelligence Agency down in New Orleans at around the time of the preparations for the Bay of Pigs. And one of Gordon's assignments was to send out radio signals, okay, about the stages of the operation as they went down to D-Day, all right? And he reportedly had a pretty big budget to go ahead and broadcast, okay, those signals from a CIA front called Evergreen Advertising, right? But I also learned later that Gordon was actually in on more than just that. He witnessed some of the training operations, you know, for the Bay of Pigs. All right, and this is how he got to know people like Ed Butler and Guy Bannister and Clay Shaw. All right, now, oh, and of course Sergio Arcacha Smith. All right,
indeed.
Now Gordon was also in on the proposed telethon that after the Bay of Pigs, in which there was a meeting at Guy Bannister's office. All right, and which Sergio Arcacha Smith was there. And they were going to raise funds through a citywide telethon, and there's a guy at that meeting who Gordon described that very much jives with the appearance of David Phillips. Okay, he was, so that's very, very interesting also.
Okay. By the way, very briefly, Sergio Arcacha Smith, one of the main cogs in the CIA's anti-Castro machinations, and
yes,
also someone who has networked with a large number of the people who figured in Garrison's investigation. And David Atlee Phillips, one of the primary CIA officers in charge of activities in the Americas, deeply involved with many of these same things, operating under the alias of Maurice Bishop, and confessed in a near-deathbed confession to being in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd of 1963. Go ahead, Jim.
Tell right.
Us. Yep.
Okay. Now, from my understanding, it's always been a mystery as to how the heck Gordon ended up in Jim Garrison's office in 1967, all right? A friend of mine told me what I'm about to relate to you. Alan Dulles knew about Gordon through the Bay of Pigs operation, and so he also knew that Gordon was very highly skilled, okay, in electronic surveillance.
Sure.
All right? And so Dulles arranged a meeting with Gordon, and he offered him an assignment to go ahead and wire Garrison's office, all right, for sound, all right? And Gordon was kind of hesitant to do it, but Dulles had brought a lot of money with him, you know, and that managed to change Gordon's mind about the assignment. So Garrison, unbeknownst, doesn't know what's going on, is introduced to Gordon by a big-time car dealer, Willard Robertson, who was backing Garrison's investigation at that time. All right? And so, again, unsuspecting of what the heck's going on, Gordon is now chief of security for Garrison's office, right? And it's very, very clear rather early what the heck Gordon is up to, right? Because as I wrote in my book, he has a meeting with a couple of state policemen, right? And he actually tells them in advance that they're going to be detailed to Garrison's investigation, right? And they were, okay? And they asked him, how the heck did you know that? And he said, words of the effect, I have connections everywhere, which he did, all right? Which he did, all right? And so Novell begins to pay people in the office to steal things off of Garrison's desk. And he meets up with Walter Sheridan, and Walter Sheridan starts paying him $500 a day. He also wants copies of the tapes that Gordon had been making for Alan Dulles. Okay? And so once Garrison hears about this, that somehow Gordon is talking to Walter Sheridan, then that was it, okay? And so Novell gets the news that Garrison is on to him. Novell was a part owner of both a speedway and a bar in New Orleans. He sold his interest in the bar. He later told me the speedway, part of the speedway, served as a kind of storage bunker for munitions for the CIA. Okay, and so he shows up in court with two lawyers, not one, but two. They ask for a delay in the proceeding, and they say Mr. Novell has no intention of fleeing the clutches of the DA. All right, he just wants a little more time to prepare his case. All right, and we will show up after the delay, after the postponement. Well, of course, that ended up being a bunch of BS because Gordon never returned to New Orleans for several years. All right, and so now what happens is that Gordon, with the help of the CIA, now begins to travel around the country going to several newspapers and reporters and magazine guys and going ahead and casting the most malignant negative aspersions that he can on Garrison's inquiry, saying that, look, I was the chief of security, so I know what this guy's up to. You know, he's a no-good faker, okay? All right? And these get, of course, in the press. I later found out through a letter that I recovered that Novell worked with something like 17 different journalists, you know, after he fled New Orleans. That became his job. And he took a phony polygraph test, all right, in the Langley area, all right, to say that he was really telling the truth, of course, when he was really lying, all right? And so this began from what I've been able to see. This really got Garrison's goat. And what made it even more angry, of course, was that when he could not get him back, you know, because this relates to another aspect of the story. That is, Jim Garrison, who had been a sterling DA for 5 years, never had any kind of extradition request blocked. Now, with the Kennedy case, he can't have any of his extradition requests honored. He can't get Gordon back to New Orleans. All right? And so, by the way, I later found out also something else, that Dulles and Gordon cooperated with the same lawyer to dodge the subpoenas and the extradition treaties, okay? A guy named Herbert Miller, a friend of Walter Sheridan, right?
The ubiquitous
so
Walter Sheridan.
That composes what I believe was the first wave of attacks on Jim Garrison. And this culminated in something else that you want to talk about later, that is the media machete job that was done by Walter Sheridan, James Phelan, Hugh Ainsworth, et cetera. Okay, yep. And that climaxed in about the summer, the late summer of 1967.
Well, we'll go into that as we develop. Something in connection with Gordon Novell, Jim, you wrote about how he was able to live well above his ostensible,
this is almost funny because, see, if you follow the guy's career, once he left New Orleans, he had no visible means of support. Okay? None. All right? And so the most amazing thing is this, that even though he didn't have any means of support, he decides to go ahead and sue Garrison, and at one time or another, and this is just mind-boggling to me that nobody ever pointed this out, he has five different lawyers representing him. Now, anybody who's ever been in any kind of legal bind knows, okay, these guys don't work for free, okay? Not in these kinds of situations. So the question then became, where the hell did Gordon get the money to pay five different attorneys? All right? And the answer came out in a deposition that I got a hold of. All right? And he said that they had been, and these are the words, clandestinely remunerated.
Aha. I guess there's an old song, Jim. Nice work if you can
now,
get it.
Is that
and
a
he
funny
got
way
it.
Of saying CIA did it?
Yeah, well,
or
yeah,
what?
Absolutely. Yeah. Again, there's an old song. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. He obviously got it. And it's nice work, although at least in terms of the compensation.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Jim, I would like to read a passage that not only involves Gordon Novell, but Walter Sheridan, whom we will get to. And I think this not only touches on the issues of the infiltrators in the garrison's investigation, but how they, on the one hand, networked directly with the media hatchet people, people like Walter Sheridan, who did to garrison's public image what person or persons unknown did to Eladio Del Valle's head. Basically, they chopped it open. And it also, I think, indicates how the ostensible upholding of the law gives way before the blatant violation of the same. I'd like to read a passage from page 239, Jim, if you would indulge me, about Marlene Mancuso. Am I pronouncing her name correctly?
Yes.
She was Gordon Novell's estranged wife. And you
right.
write again on page 239 as follows. She had been talking to Garrison. She had detailed knowledge of Gordon's agency activities with people like David Ferry and Sergio Arcacha Smith. Plus, she was fully informed about the transfer of arms from the Schlumberger bunker for the Bay of Pigs. In May of 1967, Townley, that's Rick Townley, found her working as a cashier in the quarter at a place called Lucky Pierre's. Townley told her bluntly that Garrison was going down. They wanted her to say on camera that the DA had coerced her into giving him testimony about the Schlumberger munitions transfer. When that did not work, a friend of Gordon's called her and warned her about facing federal perjury charges if she did not turn on Garrison. Finally, Walter Sheridan showed up in person. He also said that Garrison was going down the drain and she was going with him. But if she would talk to him, he would get her a job at NBC. This also failed. So Sheridan started following her around. Once he followed her to church. His excuse was that he wanted to say a prayer inside. One day, both Sheridan and Townley showed up at her front door. They said they were looking for Gordon. The next day, Townley called her and said if she did not get away from Garrison, she could get killed. Mancuso did not turn on Garrison. Moving to page 240, she signed a statement for the DA revealing the threats and extortion by Townley and Sheridan. And that is, that is quite remarkable, and I think it is something of a, not only an in vitro look into the reality of hardball politics in this country, but something of a preview into what we're going to be looking at with Walter Sheridan. Again, Gordon Novell, multifaceted intelligence officer, deeply involved with all of these activities, bugging Garrison's office, working with Garrison, and publicly lambasting Garrison. Now, that's something we didn't really talk much about. He made a bunch of public statements just ripping Garrison, and they were less than accurate, Jim. Why don't you briefly fill us in on that?
Less than accurate? Is that what you said?
Yeah, Novell's smearing at Garrison publicly, saying what Garrison was doing ostensibly.
Yeah, right. He was basically saying that Garrison was using all these kind of unethical practices Okay. You know, and he actually, I think, once said that he was using a drug-induced gun, you know, to make his the witnesses tell them what he wanted to know. Okay, that's how wild, you know, these stories became, you know, that Gordon was saying. And, you know, and like I said, this was something, you know, that Garrison really couldn't do anything about because of the failure of the extradition system. Right? You know, and he also said that Jim Garrison is power mad. His mad ambitions have run away with him. You know, he said that Garrison had advanced a bizarre plan, which entailed shooting David Ferry with a tranquilizer dart, kidnapping him, and applying as much sodium pentothal, which is true serum, as needed to get him to confess. All right, this is the kind of thing that actually got into the press.
Yep.
You know, which is a complete failure, you know, of American media, you know, to go ahead and really assess what was happening in New Orleans at that time.
Absolutely. And the Walter Sheridan is something that we will get to at big time in our next interview. His background is more than a little interesting. In addition to the threats against Marlene Mancuso, and the curious thing of Gordon Novell, Lyric Townley showing up at Walter Sheridan, following her to church, allegedly to pray. It was interesting that, according to Ms. Mancuso, Walter Sheridan offered her a job at NBC. That is sort of reminiscent of Mr. King, the Denver oil man, saying to Garrison, you know, a guy like you, you belong on the federal bench, not down here.
Right.
All these bail bondsmen. Basically, that was the carrot. And just such a carrot was being offered to Marlene Mancuso. And she did not take it. And again, I think it not only reflects on how the, quote, system, unquote, works. It's a word I hate, but it is, I guess, accurate. But it also, I think, leads us to wonder how many people have taken the carrot and then subsequently found themselves bound by those circumstances and necessarily having to toe the official line on any one of a number of things. You know, before, sort of as a transition, would you like to talk about Pershing Gervais in our last couple of minutes, or should we stick with Walter Sheridan and company?
Well, the Gervais case, that came about afterwards.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
After, as you said, Helms wrote a memo saying that we have to devise task forces for both before the trial, during the trial, and after the trial. Okay. Now, the Gervais case came after the trial when the Justice Department sent him to Canada, all right, because they wanted to keep him away from Jim Garrison while they were rehearsing their case in order to frame Garrison on these phony baloney charges, you know, that he had been taking money, you know, illegally from Gervais, okay, in order to fix cases. Well, they camped him out in Canada so that Garrison could not get to him for pretrial questioning. They gave him a phony job at General Motors in Canada, all right? And the only way that Garrison found out about him was through a report that was in the local newspapers. And it was then, of course, with that report and some other information that Garrison had, that this was all exposed as nothing but a frame-up. You know, because like we said, the idea was before, during, and after. And so the way the CIA does this is that if they can convict you on a phony charge, then you're considered to be discredited. Okay? Mm-hmm. And that's what they tried to do with Jim Garrison. You know?
And Gervais was basically the angel of no mercy in that regard.
Right, to put it lightly, yes.
Yes. Jim, we've got just a couple of minutes left. If you would tell people, and we're going to, in our next talk, we're going to go into Walter Sheridan, a very important individual, but tell people how they can order not only Destiny Betrayed, but JFK, The Evidence Today, and about Kennedys and King, and about Black Op Radio.
All right. The website that I operate is called kennedysandking.com. And you can go ahead and order either of my books, that is the earlier book, Destiny Betrayed, second edition, and the later book, The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, by punching through the links to that website. And I'm also a semi-regular on Leno Sanek's show out of Vancouver on Thursday night called Black Op Radio.
There you go. So if you would like to learn more from Jim Eugenio, those are places to do it. And again, the book Destiny Betrayed, I think, is a must read for anyone who's serious, not just about the JFK assassination, but anyone who really wants to see how things work. And that's why I'm taking the length of time that I am to delve into this book. This concludes For the Record program number 1044, interview number 13 with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on January 2nd of the year 2019. For Jim DiEugenio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.